From the Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com. Pleasant good morning to you. Hi, this is Patrick Timpone, and you've got OneRadioNetwork.com. We broadcast every morning, 9 to 11 o'clock Central Time worldwide, OneRadioNetwork.com. And also, we're pleased to be, it's over the last couple of months, on NaturalNewsRadio.com, big website around the world. Thanks to Mike Adams and his crew for allowing us to do just that. We'll tell you about some of the things that they have on the front page of Natural News Radio. A little bit later on tomorrow, one of our favorite days, Open Phone Friday, where we solve all the world's problems in 2 hours with your telephone calls. And next week, I think it's the first of the month. So for you regular folks, you know what that means. We get to visit with Adam Bergstrom. Chronobiotic nutrition, time-conscious eating, and also Dr. David Jobb there in the first part of the month. And so we're going to have some fun next week, as we always do. If you'd like to join us this morning, here's how you can do just that. 888-663-6386. That's 888-663-6386. If you're calling from around the world, it's 001. And then you dial 888-663-6386. I get confused with that. I think we dial 011 when we dial out. And then Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com is our email address. Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Next hour, we're going to talk with Dr. Thomas Levy about his new book called Primal Panacea. He's a cardiologist and has done a lot of work with vitamin C, so that should be great fun. This morning, we're going to talk about religion, in a sense, with John Lamb Lash. He was born about the same time I was, 1 year earlier, 1945. He's an American author and a comparative mythologist. He's written a bunch of books, including The Seeker's Handbook, Complete Guide to Spiritual Pathfinding, and that's about 20 years ago. Twins and the Double, Manhood and Power, Quest for the Zodiac, and latest is Not in His Image. He focuses on Gnosticism, and he's actually a critical thinker about Christianity, what it is, what it isn't, and maybe maybe not the best thing since sliced bread, as many people think. And he happens to be in Belgium. Mr. Lamb Lash, hi, how are you?
I'm very fine, thank you.
Nice to have you on the show.
It's good to be with you.
I've never really known much about Gnostics. I've always thought of them as being pagans, right? And maybe they are not believers in God. But you write that they're really people that were looking for a deep spiritual understanding long before Christianity came around.
Oh, absolutely. If anyone who subscribes to Christian religion or believes in the Bible and believes in Jesus is of the opinion that spirituality and a true relationship to the divine, true knowledge of the divine, began somehow with the Old Testament or began with even the historical Jesus, they need to take a real second look at things here. The school or the movement of the Gnostics was predating all that by thousands of years. So, and yes, they were pagans, but, you know, what's a pagan?
Yeah, what is the definition of a pagan? I mean, it certainly got a bad rap over the years, Mr. Lamb Lash.
Yeah, that's true, and it's very unfortunate, and I must say it makes me very sad to hear people in the United States who are otherwise perhaps intelligent people talk about paganism or use the word as if it was a dirty word without the faintest idea whatsoever of what that word actually means.
What does it mean?
Well, in the first place, it comes from the Latin word paganus, P-A-G-A-N-U-S, which simply means a country dweller.
A country dweller.
Hmm. Yeah. Hmm. And so the word pagan goes back to the days of the Roman Empire and the pre-Christian era, and also well after that in the Christian era, when there were in various parts of Europe big cities, you know, big urban settlements, mm-hmm. such as Rome, Athens, London, Paris, Marseille, Sevilla. These were big cities in Europe, 2,000 years ago, certainly not as big as they are today, but they were large urban areas. The difference is that at that time, the population, general population, lived mostly in the country. Not like today, where there are many countries in the world, we know, where the major part of the population lives in the city and not in the country, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you just have to go back to the time when the concentrated areas of population did exist, but the great majority of people lived in the country, and they were called pagans, people who lived in the country. So that's one definition, if you want to put it there. The second thing comes up, of course, oh, well, wait a minute. No, pagans were Satan worshippers, or they practiced human sacrifice, or they had sexual orgies, or they had no morals, they were cruel, immoral people. Or all of that is completely and utterly wrong. And it's very unfortunate that many people don't realize that when they repeat that, or when they give a negative connotation to the word pagan, they're just repeating an unexamined piece of information. If you want to understand in a nutshell what was the spiritual and moral orientation of pagan people, then I can give you a snapshot of that.
Yeah, we'd like to get that. Let's invite the listeners in. John Lamb Lash is with us, 888-663-6386, and email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. It is about 8 minutes after the hour. We're live on the 29th of September. Mr. Lash is in Belgium. Yes, we'd like to hear that.
Sure. Here, first of all, if you want to go read it for yourself, just go to the library, go to a local bookstore, and look for the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, O-U-R-E-L-I-U-S. It's a small book of 12 or 13 chapters. You can read it in an afternoon. It's not a heavy philosophical book. And it will give you a view and an understanding of the pagan, what a pagan really thought, the way a pagan thought, the philosophy of life, as it were. But I'll give you the two or three basic highlights. First of all, pagans were animists.
Animists, yes.
Yeah, animists. Mm-hmm. And that means that they perceived nature as being alive. Hmm. And so they perceived that the creator force was not somewhere outside the world, like a distant father god sitting in a cloud, mm-hmm. Who pointed his finger and created this world. No, in their view of animism, the entire world was alive. Nature was alive. And also nature, the presence of the gods and goddesses who created nature, is in nature itself. And that is what is called divine immanence, if you want to put it in theological terms. They believed in the divinity immanent in nature. Therefore, they did look at nature as a divine realm, and as something that was sacred, so they had a huge respect for nature. So that's basically their spiritual viewpoint. And the second point regarding their morality or their ethics, well, if you read in Marcus Aurelius, he says, for instance, love truth, this is a pagan adage, love truth. They believed that human beings are essentially good. They did not believe in the concept of sin. They did not believe that we are in some way flawed or fallen. They believed that human beings are essentially good and that we are here to assist each other. And the basic nature of humanity is mutual aid. So that's just a few points about pagans. I mean, they were not perfect people. They had flaws like other human beings do. There was murder in the pagan world. There was dishonesty. There was a certain amount of crime. But it was nothing like the world in which we live today. And also, there was a lot more humanistic compassion in the pagan world than there was in the subsequent Christian civilization that replaced it.
Mm-hmm. So when did this idea come about that this unknowable, or the however we got here, this thing, however it works, whatever this concept of God is, when did it come around, Mr. Lash, that it was separate from us? Who started that idea?
Well, the idea that God is separate from us is a belief that is primarily enforced in the Judeo-Christian and Islamic religions. And when you go back into history and you look at that belief and compare it to other religious views, you find immediately two remarkable points. The first point is that it has not been the norm in most other religions around the world to view God as separate. On the contrary, it's rather an exception. Most other religions around the world, such as Hinduism or the Taoism of ancient China, viewed God or the divine principle as being connected to us. We are in the web of life, and God is also a part of that same web of life. So there was no separation between creature and created. The second point that you'll discover if you study these things in any depth is that the idea that creature and creator are separate was enforced by people who wanted to use religion for political purposes. And the best example of that, of course, is the Emperor Constantine, who made Christianity the state religion of the Roman Empire.
And what year was that about?
That was around 325 AD. So Christianity had been developing as a belief system, mainly among the slave population of the Roman Empire, for about 300 years. And then the Emperor Constantine, who found his empire falling apart, he was losing authority for various reasons that didn't have all completely to do with the rise of Christianity. He was losing control, and he saw this new religion becoming very popular among the slaves and the masses. This religion of the Messiah or the Sal or the Savior. And he thought, I got a good idea. I'll just make that religion my state religion, and I'll claim that the authority that comes from God is my authority. And since nobody can reach God, and God is separate from people, I will have an authority that cannot be questioned. And so what you'll find, that this notion that God is separate from human beings always goes along with an agenda of political domination, because the people who adopt religion for that purpose then have an authority in the name of God, and that authority cannot be questioned.
Cannot be questioned.
It's a very sinister game. Yeah.
So he was then one of the first people to get this idea, Constantine, that went on then throughout the whole thing with, in the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, King Henry VIII and all these people, where they were, even to this day, I guess, some of the kings, even I guess the King of England, even Queen of England, she claims that she has received her authority from God as well.
You're talking about the concept of the divine right of kings.
Divine right of kings. Well said. Yeah. See, I just kind of... Yeah.
Concept of the divine right of kings actually precedes Constantine. You can find that it was born in... it probably emerged sometime in the Middle East, some time before Constantine. But in the history that's impacting us today in this world, we look to Constantine as the person who consolidated church and state. And, of course, there's been a lot of attempts to separate church and state. There are people, you know, the founding fathers of the United States themselves had a big problem with that, because they recognized the danger that when a politician stands in front of you, an elected politician, and if he makes a mistake, he's responsible to the people who elected him. But if that elected politician, who might even be the president, claims to have his authority from God, then the people are going to be powerless against him. He's not accountable, as it were. So it's a very sinister game that is used.
Yeah. And when you want to become king, you're just kind of... Your father or mother gave you this, you know, your dad was king, so you get to be king. So I guess it's really kind of beneficial to say, well, we received our power and our family from God, so how can you question that?
Yeah, and the amazing thing is it works. Because
sure, it's worked. It worked for a long time.
You know, people don't question it, unfortunately. There have been struggles through the ages to try to separate church and state and to try to break this deadlock, but as we see today, you know, in many parts of the world, the leaders of the United States still cite God in Congress. They still use the Bible, and there's an implication, even if there isn't a direct imputation of authority, there's an implication. It's like even Lloyd Blankfein, you know, who's nothing but a crook and a gangster and a financial terrorist, stands in front of a committee of U.S. Congress and says, oh, we're doing God's work.
Oh, president, you know? Of Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We're doing God's work. Mm-hmm. By looting and raping the common working person is God's work, you know? So it's a transparently disingenuous way to hold power over people.
Do you think as many people in this country believe, and I've heard people call into talk shows over the years, I love to listen to talk shows, and they say, well, this is a Christian nation. Do you think it is?
I don't know. How do you define a Christian nation, you know, and what difference would it make if it wasn't, you know? It's like the assumptions behind that statement are very charged, aren't they?
What do you think people are trying to assume when they say that?
I'll tell you what I think they're trying to assume. And I grew up in a very tight Christian community in Maine, a fundamentalist Christian community, if you will. I don't dislike Christians as people, by the way. Don't get me wrong there. I've nothing against them as human beings. What I do in my work as a writer and someone who examines belief systems is that I look at the ideology, the belief system, and I am very critical of the belief system of Christianity. You'll find that presented in my last book, Not in His Image. But that doesn't mean I'm attacking the humanity of Christians. But there is a claim that Christians make that is utterly false. And I think that that claim may be the inference, the main inference that's behind this statement, we are a Christian nation. The false claim is that Christians are somehow better than other people in the world, that they somehow have a brotherly love and a spirit of goodness and goodwill that doesn't exist in anyone who is not an adherent to the Christian faith. And I'm afraid that that assumption is held by many Christians, and unfortunately that is a very, very wrong assumption, and it's extremely divisive and extremely harmful.
The idea of knowing or experiencing truth, or what might call God or the divine, and believing in it, can there be a... There must be... I guess we have to have some kind of faith or belief before we can get to the point where we can try to know or experience God.
Well, it's a really big subject. It's not something we can certainly, you know, cover very well in the short time we have here, but I'll just take you back to the main topic of my last book.
Not in His Image.
Not in His Image,
right.
Yeah. Obviously addresses an assumption of many people of Judeo-Christian lineage who are very proud to say, we are made in God's image. We are made in the image of the Creator. We
right.
humans are special. And I try to show that belief, which is simply what it is untrue. I question that belief. But I don't just question it in a nasty way to try to tear it down. And, you know, I also propose for consideration another way of viewing this matter, to say we are not made in God's image, and that our understanding of God should be a matter of knowledge and not a matter of mere faith in something that's written in a book that God himself was supposed to have written, you know? So it raises the question, is it possible to have direct knowledge of God or of the divine or of the creative force of the universe, whatever you want to call it? And I answer that question in my book quite thoroughly, because I explain that in the ancient world of Europe, where I am now, in the classical world of Europe, before Christianity, there was a class of intellectual teachers and, you could say, spiritually enlightened people, men and women, who were called Gnostikoi. Greek word Gnostikoi means those who know, people who know. Hmm. Well, what is it that they knew? Well, they knew how it is possible for each individual to have a verifiable relationship to what we call God. For them, it was a matter of knowledge and not a matter of faith.
A verifiable, in other words, some kind of direct experience.
That's right. Mm. And not only verifiable to the individual person, because obviously this is an experience that is deeply subjective, so everyone has to have it for themselves. It's a bit like sex, or it's a bit like eating eating some really good ice cream, you know, some really good strawberry ice cream. You have to have that experience for yourself to know what it really is. Other people can tell you about it and say it's really good to have sex, it's really good to eat strawberry ice cream. But when you have it for yourself, you know, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, likewise, they claimed that you can have a direct experience to God, who is here, present in the natural world, present for us, with us in the human world, present to us. Again, that's what they call theologically immanent divinity, as compared to transcendent divinity, meaning that God lies somewhere outside this world. Okay?
Yes. And then what do you make of the idea then organized religions then teach the opposite? I was raised Catholic, and we needed the priest or the mass.
Right.
So we needed all this stuff to make that connection. We needed a middleman.
That's right.
To make that connection.
Well, all I can say is that pagans did not believe in a middleman between an individual human being and God. And the Gnostics went even further, and they said it's teachable. The connection to God is a teachable connection. They never attempted to set up an organized religious hierarchy like the Catholic Church or any other church. They never presented themselves as middlemen. They said, anyone can learn how to contact God because we have that innate capacity in each of us. But they even went further. They said that if it is done in the right way, and everyone verifies it for themselves, then we can all agree voluntarily in a general sense, not on every particular detail, but we can all agree in a general sense in what the nature of God is. So we don't need someone to, like, speak to us in a pyramidal fashion and dictate to us what God is. We can actually arrive at an enlightened consensus about the Creator and about the earth, and about such questions as why are we here, and what is the purpose of suffering, and what is the purpose of existence. So they were very, very, very deeply immersed in this subject and had some profound answers, which I lay out in my book, Not in His Image. And when Christianity arose, it's a very interesting thing. I just want to make this point to those of you who listening to this conversation who maybe Christians may be a little doubtful about what I'm saying. When Christianity arose 2,000 years ago, it could not allow this Gnostic pagan philosophy to coexist with it. For some reason, rather than Christianity, the first Christians just going along and saying, oh, well, these other people have their ideas about God, but Christianity is better, and because it's obviously so better, we know that people will choose it, so we'll just let the pagans and the Gnostics coexist with us. We won't bother with them because they're the competition, but they will eventually fade out because Christianity is such a better way.
The truth will rise to the top.
Right, but they didn't do that. They exterminated those people. down to the last person. They destroyed everything that they wrote. They destroyed the books and the universities where they taught. Now, why did they have to do that? If Christianity was such a good way for humanity, if it was so right and so true, why did it have to destroy a competing system? Why couldn't the truth of Christianity just stand for itself against that system? I ask you to think about that if you're a Christian.
26 minutes after the hour with John Lamb Lash, 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. So from those who know looking for a direct experience, then the big difference was when Jesus came to the scene. And that's what began to bring this idea of Christianity in, or was it before? And forgive me if it's a dumb question, but I mean, what is the main idea of Christianity based on this man named Jesus who came here to suffer and forgive us sins so we could go to heaven? Is that the main idea of Christianity?
Well, the main idea of Christianity is that humanity is flawed.
Oh, sin.
Yeah, we are flawed, or we have a problem that we can't solve among ourselves, and so we need divine intervention. And the main idea is that God, the creator of this earth, has a plan to save us. So that's why I call Christianity a salvationist religion. And according to this plan, God orchestrated a particular event that is allowing a particular human being to take the form of his emissary, the Savior, and to perform this act of sacrifice, and so forth and so on. So this is the whole complex belief system of Christianity. Now, when we could talk about this for a long time. I don't want to get into a tar baby syndrome here, talking about it too much. But let me just throw one point at you that you might never have heard before. When this notion that the Creator God, who lives somewhere beyond the earth, orchestrated an event in which his emissary and savior came to the earth and was crucified and cruelly murdered for some higher purpose and all of this. When the pagans of the classical world 2,000 years ago heard this story going around, because at first it just went around, you know, as a kind of a rumor before it got established, then it got established as an official religious doctrine. But at first it was just a rumor, and people were saying, well, this could have really happened, and, you know, maybe this really did happen, and boy, just imagine, it would really be important, it would make a big change in our lives if this was true. And the pagans of that time heard this story, and they were, like, really shocked. And the thing that shocked them the most about this story, first of all, they thought it was untrue. They thought it was sick. And the thing that shocked them most about it was that the story of Jesus and the basic message of Christianity claims that there is a higher value to suffering, some divine plan. And it not only states directly that Jesus suffered because of the divine will of the Father so that humanity could be saved, but it also, by implication, and I think you would agree with this, tell me if you don't, by implication, it also implies that those of us humanly who suffer might be involved in the divine plan as well. And even though we don't want to suffer, we accept it because it's maybe God's way of bringing us to something that we need. You see?
Hmm.
You're aware with that form of thinking.
So the idea that we have to suffer to reach the truth,
and to have, and to fulfill God's purpose, God's will in some way.
What would God's will be that we have to suffer to realize God?
Yeah, to realize God's purposes, you know.
Hmm.
For just the way Jesus had to suffer to fulfill God's mission, right? That humanity be saved, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to suffer. I mean, it's a common belief among all Christians that I've known, and certainly in Catholicism. I mean, my God, man, they glorify suffering to a huge, huge degree in Catholicism.
So do you think perhaps that people have taken the concept of no pain, no gain, or personal growth sometimes is uncomfortable because we have to let go of something that we really like, you know, that's not good for us, and they've morphed that into this suffering thing?
Well, to get back to my point about how the pagans viewed this, this may be helpful to people who've never heard this before. What I'm saying is that in Christianity, there is an implicit message. There's a kind of glorification of suffering. Certainly the suffering of Jesus is like a glorified event. It's a divine gift. And there's the idea that we as human beings suffer, but, you know, in the end, it's because we need to come through to some deep truth about God or some deep truth, some deep meaning. Pagans viewed this as horrific. They thought it was really, really sick. It was not because they didn't suffer. They realized that life contains both joy and suffering. And a healthy human being can learn both from joy and suffering. But to invest suffering alone with some supreme or mysterious meaning and value, they considered that to be absolutely pathological. And so they rejected this Christianity simply on that grounds alone. And that's what I call the rejection of the redemptive value of suffering. It's completely against the pagan viewpoint. Pagans accept suffering as something that happens in human reality. And we can all be deepened, and we can all learn from it. But it is not an instrument of divine purpose. That is a completely insane idea.
In other words, not this challenge that we overcome that might be termed suffering was not placed upon us just because we got unlucky. And is that what you're saying? In other words, this was placed upon us by God because we've got to do this hurdle to get to Him.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's it, exactly. It was not, they saw that, and their interpretation of that in their day was, this is really bad news. This is not a good belief system. And furthermore, it makes people accept suffering when perhaps they shouldn't. It allows them to accept victimhood and to be victims and to think that there is some divine mission in being a victim. And that's a very, very dangerous road to take. But unfortunately, we have been pushed down that road. Mm. And today, a lot of the problems in this world, all over the world, are focused on one particular country, whose history is deeply connected with the Bible. And if you go look at that particular country, you'll find that they have a habit of playing the victim. And then behind the game of playing the victim, they commit some of the worst atrocities that you can name that are happening on this planet as we speak. So this victim game is very deeply rooted in the Judeo-Christian religion, and I've tried to expose that and reveal that in my book, Not in His Image.
And what country is that?
Well, it's a country where all the events of the Old Testament took place.
Are you speaking of Israel?
Yes, that's mm-hmm. right.
Right. Okay, stay right there. John Lamb Lash. What do you think about this? If you'd like to join us, you're welcome to do so. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com, and you can try the international line of 001, the 888 number. His latest book is Not in His Image, and that was a couple of years ago. Focuses on narcissism and the myth of Sophia. Several days ago, we talked with Michael Payne of Living Well Today International. I've known Michael for a couple of years, and we're excited about this because he's really worked out the whole dynamics and the method to get one of these Zydo instruments to you in the mail. You put a little deposit, and you get your money back, and then he'll do a session with you over the Internet. Get on the phone, and he gets on the computer with you, and you put your hand in there, and through this galvanic response and through the meridians, you can see amazing things about your body, some of your allergies, whether you have parasites, what kind of viruses you have. I mean, it's pretty fantastic. It's real space-age medicine, but he's been doing it for years, and it works. And then he can work with you, if you wish, on taking care of those things through his functional food locker and some of his physician kind of level supplements and nutrients. But you don't have to do that. You can just, get the information and then work on it on yourself. And I'm sorry, I didn't get the exact price, but I think it's in the $150 range special for you for the next month or so. And so just click through with the lady with the little blue bikini kind of thing on, Living Well Today International. It's also in this store. Check it out. And this is exciting because no matter where you live, you could have the opportunity of working with Michael, who I really trust, and I guarantee you'll have a good experience, and then helping you to get that your health to another level. Right on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com. Daniel Vitalis, let's play a game. On a desert island, you can only pick one food. Just one. Just only one.
If I had to live off of one food, I think it would be, if I had any choice, it'd probably be colostrum. It's the most complete food that I know of. And the thing about colostrum is it's the first food for any mammal. So it's kind of a no-brainer that colostrum contains all essential fats, it contains all essential amino acids, it contains all essential glyconutrients, which are carbohydrates. It basically contains every substance that we need to maintain our bodies. The first milking you get from a cow after the cow calves is called colostrum. Every milking thereafter is called transitional milk. And what it is it's part colostrum and part milk. So that's something that can happen in the industry because people will sell you the transitional milk and call it colostrum. We're very careful not to do that. We only use the first milking of the animals.
Pure colostrum from SirThrival. They take the moisture out. That's it. To order, click on the picture of colostrum, front page, OneRadioNetwork.com.
Could saving 15% of your money in gold coins really save you money on your car insurance? No. But it sure will give you a lot of peace of mind in uncertain times. Protecting your wealth is a great idea in an economy where money is being inflated by the rapid expansion of the money supply by central banks all over the world. Learn to protect your wealth. We can be reached directly to answer your questions at 1-800-878-2646 or visit us on the web at usgoldcoins.com.
And the dollar is down about 44 basis points this morning. Crude oil is up $2.20 and gold is up 10 bucks and silver is up 62. And there you have it from OneRadioNetwork.com and SDL.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network. Talk to Patrick now, 888-663-6386, or email patrick@oneradionetwork.com.
We're going to talk to Dr. Thomas Levy about his latest book next hour. He's a good one. A lot of stuff about vitamin C, dental health, cardiovascular health. Right now with John Lamb Lash, having an interesting conversation. His latest book in his work, focuses on Gnosticism. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. Let's take a couple calls, 888-663-6386. Hi, what's your first name? Where are you calling from? Hello? Whoops, if I pressed the button. Hi, what's your first name? Where are you calling from?
This is Francis from Edmonton.
Hi, Francis. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Hey, John. Nice to hear your story.
Thank you.
I have a question for you. Did you have a chance to listen to Obama's speech on September the 11th?
No, I didn't.
Where he recited Psalm 46?
No, I didn't hear that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you familiar with Psalm 46?
No, I'm not. Not off the top of my head.
Okay. Well, I'll just give you a couple of ditties from it, right? Like Obama and Psalm 46, he recites about whoever this is, I'm not sure. He talks about the God of Jacob, right?
Mm-hmm.
That he's in his refuge, right? That's what the Psalm talks about. Obama takes it, like he puts a personal twist on it, I believe. But he also mentions something out else about another entity who in the psalm is referred to as the Lord of hosts.
Right,
so it just occurs to me that there's more than one entity that he was talking about, and I'm just wondering from the Gnostic view what you think. I found it pretty disgusting myself.
Yeah, well, you know, the Bible is a very confused document. It's a pastiche of different pieces edited with many inconsistencies. One of the first things that you will notice when you start reading the Bible with an intelligent viewpoint, not like a zombie, everyone notices this, that although the assumed premise of the Bible is that there is one supreme Father God creator and one only, Yahweh, Jehovah, or whatever, there is all through the Bible, there are mentionings of other divinities, and the use of the word Elohim and various Lord of Hosts expressions like this in the plural. So what's the thing going on here? If there's only one supreme creator deity, how come the Bible, you know, is alluding to, in a number of passages, other deities as well? Well, that's because, as a matter of fact, polytheism, or the viewpoint that there is more than one deity, was pervading the ancient world, and a lot of it leaked into the Bible, and so it comes out still in the language of the Bible today.
This whole idea with politics, Mr. Lash,
mixing religion and politics is really bad news.
It's almost like we're having a war now with the Bible against the Quran or something. Two books
that are
fighting each other. It seems a bit curious.
Yeah, well, it seems curious that the religions that claim to be the religion, supreme religion of love, which is Christianity, which, by the way, uses the instrument, the symbol of a Roman torture instrument, the cross, to symbolize divine love. I mean, how do you put that together? A torture instrument symbolizes divine love, okay. And then Islam, the so-called religion of peace, and all we get out of these religions is war and division. So there's something here that's not right, you know. There's something here that's not straight. And what I challenge people to do in my website and in my book is to exercise a little bit of common sense and scrutiny and look at religion and see if it's really what it pretends to be, or if there may not be another agenda inside it. And if you do that, I think you'll find that religion is cynically used by politicians such as the President of the United States, you know, to manipulate and control people.
What do you
think
it is? What's your opinion, John Lash, of what it is about humans that they want to have their belief, their religion, to be the one, and they sometimes will kill each other over it if somebody doesn't believe differently, like you explained early on with the pagans, and it's been going on since the beginning of time, people fighting over whose God is better, my God is better than your God. What is that
right,
about?
But the pagans didn't do that, because paganism was a polytheistic world, and there were many different shades. It was kind of like a rainbow coalition. And pagans were extremely tolerant. In fact, one of the reasons for the downfall of the pagan world, the downfall of the pagan classical civilization in Europe, was due to its tolerance, because it had never encountered the intolerance that is enshrined in the Judeo-Christian religion, which is very, very intolerant toward any other belief system. It wants to be the totalitarian system. And the pagan people were not prepared for this. It took them by surprise. They would have peacefully coexisted along with the rise of Christianity. But the rise of Christianity, as I explained in our previous conversation, would not allow for a peaceful coexistence with them. So I think that when you look into these problems, it can get very complicated. And it helps to just bear in mind that when you have something that calls itself religion, but the behavior that comes from it is divisive and leading to war and murder and retribution, then it may not be worth considering that it's religion, and you might want to go look elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. I'm quite struck sometimes when I think about John Kennedy had almost didn't get elected because people knew he was Catholic. And today we have that people will come out with fundamentals, Christianity being Christian, mostly in the Republican Party, but it goes all over, as a kind of a badge of honor. And this is what I am, so you should vote for me. Pretty interesting.
I know, but how much hypocrisy does that conceal, you know? I mean, in an ideal world, politics, the qualifications of a politician should have nothing to do with religion. I mean, this is ridiculous. The qualifications of a governor of a state ought to be based on the capacities of that person to govern and on their responsibility and their social conscience. And whatever they believe, whatever their personal relationship to God is, it's their own business, you know. It should have nothing to do. Unfortunately, these things have become terribly, terribly mixed up. And I would say that the sad result is that religion and politics contaminate each other.
It would appear so, because people can win elections now simply because of their social agenda, which, if you really understand the Constitution, as I do, and the Founding Fathers and their intent, if that means anything, it wasn't anything about a social agenda. Matter of fact, it was very clear that the government had no part in people's social activities, who they married or anything.
Well, you know,
anything.
It's been 10 years now since 9/11, isn't it? And some of us, because of the shock of that event, some people have never gone out of the shock of that event. They're gone. They're zombies. They're lost. But some of us...
What do you mean?
They were so shocked by that event and that they believed the cover story of 19 hijackers.
Sure.
And they're going along with the whole false war on terror, and they're just caught in a movie that they can't get out of. But for some other people, 9/11 was a shock of a wake-up call to, like, start to question things and to look at how things work. And one of the best things that's come in this 10 years of education since 9/11, and I think you might agree on this, I'd like to know what you think, is that we have been redirected in America back to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and we have been forced to go back and look at what the actual foundations of the American Republic were and learn about them. And that's a very good thing.
Yes, sir. And matter of fact, the key thing there, you said, is a republic and not a democracy.
That's right. That's right. It's a republic. It's not a democracy. It's a republic that operates on a democratic system of elections. But the principles that rule the democracy are republican principles enshrined in these documents. And, you know, it's a very shocking thing in the wake of 9/11 to hear the President of the United States say, well, the Constitution is just a piece of paper, you know. Very, very shocking. But you know how it is. I think you might agree with me on this. This is not particularly an esoteric comment. Only when things are really in danger do we begin to understand their true value.
Generally, yes.
Yeah.
But with all of this talk, of course, of 2012 and all these possibilities of earth changes, and we see what's going on in the geopolitical world, it appears this is what we're really, World War III is really a religious war.
That's right.
Do you agree?
Yeah, well, World War III is a war in which religion is being used as the reason for the war, you know? And that's planned. That's deliberate.
Sure.
That just doesn't come about by accident.
This has been a well-thought-out plan, you think?
Yeah. Do you know about the three wars that were described by Albert Pike?
I don't know Albert Pike, no.
Well, if you must absolutely go on Google, and you must go to Google Albert Pike, P-I-K-E, who was the head of the Freemason movement in Europe in the 19th century, and put Albert Pike, Three Wars, and you will come up with a one-page document, I swear to you, it's no longer than a page long, typewritten page, in which he actually describes about 1860... The First World War, the Second World War, and the Third World War. And he describes them as deliberate agendas of a kind of secret controlling elite group who are planning and set up these wars. And he describes the Third World War as a war between religions. But it's not really a war between religions, because the people who subscribe to these religions, namely Christianity and Islam, don't want war. They don't want to kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
But their religious belief systems are being used as a pretext to set up a war and to pit them falsely against each other. And Albert Pike laid this out. I mean, it's one of the most shocking documents you will ever read.
We'll do that. So you Google Albert Pike's the Three Wars.
Yeah, Albert Pike, Three World Wars, and you'll come up with this document. It's very well known among certain researchers into the, you know, New World Order type of thing.
Okay. Hi, what's your first name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, Patrick. It's Sharon here.
Hi.
Hi, Mr. Lash. I don't
Hello.
Usually do this, but we did receive an email last night. We did not understand what it meant. I'm going to read this to you and see if you can understand it. Okay, the title is Lucifer. Did he get a bad rap? Masons, especially Al Pike, seem to get bashed unmercifully by certain individuals. Most seem to be British Commonwealth subjects on the alternative internet programs and talk circuit conferences.
You have to speak up. You have to speak up for us.
Did you get any of that?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, we got it, but speak up a little louder, please.
Okay, he says, Masons, especially Al Pike, who you were just talking about, seem to get bashed unmercifully by certain individuals. Most seem to be British Commonwealth subjects on the alternative programs and talk circuit conferences.
Yeah.
So I don't. He was asking, did he get a bad rap? But he entitled it Lucifer. I'm not real sure what he's talking about.
Well, it's a very confusing message. Anyway, I'm not bad rapping Albert Pike. I'm just telling you, he was a head mason who wrote a document which shockingly lays out the agenda of three world wars 150 years before they happened. And it's something to look at. I mean, this is not a fake document. This is actually true.
Okay.
So I don't know what to make of that.
All right. Yeah, I wrote back to him and asked him to rephrase it, but we never heard back.
Sure.
All right, my dear. Thanks.
Hey, thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Sharon, our co-producer.
Great.
Yeah. She's a great lady who listens all the time to the show so she could tell people what's going on in the show. And I saw that email, too, and I got a little confused. Well, this Al Pike idea, that's very, very interesting. But I want to go back a second. How do politicians around the world, explain in the last 5 minutes that we have, Mr. Lash, use religion? Because, is it this idea that they create terrorism and they create this brand name as terrorists and we got to kill them all because they want to kill us? And then they connect that then with the Islamic faith, and that's how they're using religion?
Unfortunately, though, if you read the Quran, which will turn your blood cold, you'll find that a great deal of the Quran actually states murderous intention toward non-Muslims.
Of course, you hear that all the time by the politicians.
Well, it's true. Yeah. I mean, it's literally true. There's no way you can argue around it or apologize for it. But equally so, if you read the Old Testament, the behavior of Jehovah has been compared to a psychopath. And the murder and genocide and slaughter that is performed in the name of the Creator in the Old Testament is enough to choke you, you know? So, like, you have to ask yourself, if you're a religious person who wants to have some understanding of God and how we got here and what we're doing here, you really have to ask yourself if these religious documents are actually valid expressions of human spirituality, or are they just documents that have intentionally been written to manipulate people into violence and division using religion. And my argument, and not in his image, is that that's exactly what they are, and that you will not find genuine spirituality in the Bible or in the teachings of Jesus. You won't find it there, because they weren't written initially for that purpose.
Is the Bible, is the Quran as big a brand name, if you will, in other parts of the world as the Bible is, say, here?
Oh, absolutely.
How many
Muslims there are in the world? But, you know, they're brainwashed. And many of the people who read the Bible are also brainwashed. They don't question it. They don't bring critical scrutiny to it. They don't look at the contradictions. And it's unfortunate that these religious or so-called religious texts are actually social brainwashing tools. And to have true religion and a true relationship to God and to divine and to love and to goodness, don't need any of that. We don't need that. It's been forced on us by on false pretenses. And unfortunately, we've gone very, very far down the road under those false pretenses.
Are you optimistic at all, John Lash, of the geopolitical, religious connections and what's happening and what will happen in the next few years? Are you optimistic that we'll make it through this as a species or as a country?
I think that the fate of our species hangs in the balance. I think it hangs by a thread. And I think the key to it all is for each and every person to get back to their humanity in themselves, independent of what they're told to believe, the real humanity we feel in each of us in our heart, to get back to conscience, not the commandments of the Bible, not what we're told God says you must do or you must not do, but what your conscience tells you to do. So to get back to humanity, to conscience, and to get back to our connection to the natural world. You know, your program is about nature and healing. And the pagans totally believed that nature is healing. And they were masters of natural medicine and herbs and biology. Mm-hmm. And we've lost that through these otherworldly religions, which are driving us to destruction. So I think it's an extremely precarious situation. I'm not going to call it either way, because that's not a good idea. But it is precarious. Very, very precarious. We're at the edge of the abyss. There's no question about that.
And just in general, this dogmatism, dogmatic idea and absolutism about this separateness, certainly there's something going on. There is a divine and there's other realities. There's all kinds of things going on that one can call God or truth. But somehow we are all connected to that. We're all part of that, but we're not that at the same time. And there has to be a way that people that do believe in some God other than themselves and other people can still be together and be friends.
Well, I don't think that we can. If people place their God outside of the human world and then look to that God for some dictates that are written in a book or come through an intermediary.
This is what to do, not to do, and then sin
we've
and all
got a problem
that.
that's not going to be solved. Hmm. My suggestion is, listen, I'm not the Pope here. I'm not infallible, you know, and I don't have all the answers. But I'll tell you what works for me in life is, like, let's see if we can find God through our humanity that connects each other. You know, we are connected to each other in our humanity. So let's see if we can go through our humanity to find God rather than go out of our humanity to find God. Mm-hmm. That would be my suggestion.
And this whole idea of sin, and then we all make mistakes and we say, oh, I don't want to do that anymore. Some people will call that a sin. Some other people might call it just a learning experience. But we sure know from a health aspect, Mr. Lash, that if we really have negative thoughts about ourselves, our body gets sick. There's no doubt about it. So sin doesn't work.
The body never lies. The body never lies. And these religions condemn the body, you know. Christianity, in certain respects, condemns the body. Islam condemns the body. Look at what they do to women. Look at the sexual apartheid in Islamic religion, Islamic culture. It's a horrible thing. So the wisdom of the body is also part of what's going to save us, what's going to get our species to the next place and get us back to sanity. The wisdom of the body is a great, great key to our survival.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Lash, thanks so much for spending some time with us. What's on your agenda moving forward? How do you spend your time these days?
Oh, I just spend my time enjoying life and talking to people and trying to reach other human beings. Trying to reach another human being is a great challenge these days.
Yeah. Is Europe a good place to be these
days?
It's
the same everywhere, my friend. The human condition is the same everywhere, and it's very difficult to actually reach another human being and have a heart-to-heart moment of truth.
Yeah.
But that's what I enjoy doing, and that's what I try to do on every occasion.
Well, I think we did a little bit of that this morning, so thanks for doing
that. I think
that.
We did, yeah.
We did, yeah. John Lamlash. And did you have a main website that we can go to?
Just metahistory.org, metahistory.org.
Metahistory.org.
You can also write me at that website.
And you have an email there. All right, Mr. Lash.
Yes.
Thanks so much. Have a pleasant day.
You too. Thank you.
Been a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
John Lamlash. Well, that was fun. And I hope you enjoyed that. And now we're going to get into this wisdom of the body with Dr. Thomas Levy. You've heard about him, huh? His latest book is called Primal Panacea. And we're going to do that right after this. I'm with Al Carter, the world's foremost authority on rebound exercise. Al, you patented it, designed the Rebound Air. How can you possibly give a lifetime warranty on a piece of equipment?
Because we designed it to be used by the United States Air Force and showed us how we could make sure that the equipment would last a very, very long time.
So if a spring breaks or if a mat would rip or something with a leg, you replace it?
Yes. Call us up and we'll replace it right away.
Lifetime.
Lifetime.
Order yourself a rebounder right now. Front page, look at the display for the rebounders on OneRadioNetwork.com. Go through PayPal, very secure, don't have to be a PayPal member. Any credit card, ship it via UPS in 3 days or so. It's all yours, right on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's health motivator Daniel Vitalis and the benefits of using a far infrared sauna.
Sweating is absolutely going to be one of the most critical things discerning people take on so that they can not only stay healthy, but actually so we can continue to have children that are healthy. We're going to need to sweat. People have sweat all through history. Before the world was toxic, they used that for their health. Now that it's toxic, it's one of the only ways we're going to cleanse our body fat. Our body fat is where we store so much of the environmental pollution. And by the way, one of the great things about sweating is it's how we detoxify fluoride. So if you've grown up in a place where the water was fluoridated or used fluoridated toothpaste throughout your life, or you got fluoride treatments from your dentist, you can get that fluoride out of your teeth, out of your bones, and most importantly, out of your pineal gland through sweating.
Explore a fast, easy, affordable way to detox with the portable Relax Far Infrared Sauna. Great price. Use the promo code ONERADIO for a substantial discount on OneRadioNetwork.com. Yeah, we're going to talk to Dr. Thomas Levy in just a couple of seconds. Just a quick reminder about one of our favorite things these days. It is the BioAge Microalgae, BioAge Biofood, and Dr. Michael Kiriak put this together over many, many years in Russia, working with the Russian government, where they had a lot of rubles to work with, and they just wanted to figure out how to keep animals healthy because they were treated so poorly. You know how they do these factory farms. Terrible. And also then with radiation exposure over there from Chernobyl. And it was many years that they worked on all these different algaes. And they finally got to the point where this synergy of three or four different algaes, a red algae and a couple of other ones, provided the most support for the body and the whole awakening the genius within with the hypothalamus pituitary axis that Michael Payne talked about. This is really an exciting product. I don't get this jazzed about products very often. You know how many I've been exposed to in my 30 years of playing around with natural health things and being on the radio. But this is a real deal, and we don't, as you know, we don't promote a lot of things, just a few select things. It's BioAge, Bio Superfood. Try a couple bottles and just see if you can't really tell the difference and get some energy. And this is just food now, too, so your body knows how to just to deal with it. And they make this microalgae in these enclosed biocompressor kind of things, and they're using water from deep in the ocean, so there's no exposure to any kind of toxicity in the air, mercury or chemicals and stuff like that, or radiation. Pretty cool. BioAge, BioFood, right on the front page and in our store of OneRadioNetwork.com.